From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The wildlife biologist John Shivick says when a wolf or a bear kills a cow or a sheep, or when we kill that predator in retaliation, it sends ripples through our psychological and economic zeitgeist. And there's no sugarcoating either of those deaths, he says. These realities ought to be uncomfortable. Shivick believes the distance of having others do our killing for us has warped our perceptions. So he's written a book that explores what he calls the predator paradox. It's about the attempt to control predators and yet protect them at the same time. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about it, about the interface of humans and animals and the environment and the way to end the conflict. Join us after the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John Shivick says we want it both ways. Citizens and scientists want a healthy, safe environment, an abundant food supply. But we also want dangerous carnivores, predators, to be able to expand across the landscape free from the risk of extinction. That's the predator paradox, the name of Shivick's new book. At the center of this is a war, really, on predators, particularly here in the West. We've been killing wolves and coyotes and bears and cougars for decades and decades, of course. We've been motivated by certain values and fears, he says. And Shivick says the idea is to try to find a balance in all of that. And he says there is a way if we can embrace both the nature of diversity and the diversity of nature. His book is called The Predator Paradox, Ending the War with Wolves, Bears, Cougars, and Coyotes. And John Shivick is joining us today to talk about it. John Shivick is an adjunct professor at Utah State University, where he teaches about the behavior and management of wolves, bears, cougars, and coyotes. He's studied mammalian predators throughout the United States and Europe. He's regarded as an authority on non-lethal methods for controlling predators. And John Shivick, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, I guess I wanted to. I took note of the fact that you dedicated this book to your son, whose name is Fox.
It is.
Is Fox predator? Is it the predator thing? Is that
no.
Does that reflect anything
no,
like that?
No, that's just sort of a fortuitous thing. It's actually an old family name. His grandfather, great grandfather, back a few generations were named Fox, and yeah, it's kind of by accident.
Well, I guess, but it does raise the question. I did wonder how beyond. There's the professional part of this for you, the scientific interest for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever regard it as a – because you've been studying this for a long time now. Do you regard it as a personal matter for you as well?
Absolutely. You get to a point in your career, especially as an academic, where you realize that you're kind of preaching to the choir and that you're publishing papers that only your colleagues are reading. And you realize that if you want to make a difference in the world or really – you know, get the word out. You need to kind of get out of your comfort zone. And that's what this book represents in a lot of ways.
You know, it's interesting. And this is a theme. And I want to come back to this as we go. But it seems like there's a theme in there about – and I wonder if you worry about this being in the academy. If you worry that you get as isolated as ranchers might in rural communities in terms of their thinking about predators. Do you know what I mean? That we're not talking enough about each other, that we're only hearing from voices that agree with us.
Right, yeah. And that's the issue here. And I think in looking at this topic and looking at this book, I'm treading a lot of thin ice and a lot of fine lines and threading a lot of needles with it because I very much sympathize and understand where the ranchers, the farmers, and those folks are coming from. And I very much understand and sympathize with where animal advocates or rights or those kinds of folks are coming from, and obviously where hunters are coming from too. So the difficulty is trying to present some solutions, some ways that we can all talk to each other a little better and actually get these conversations going and figure out what long-term solutions are to some of the issues that we have.
It's pretty emotional, isn't it, this issue? I think, you know, in terms of predators, I mean, you talk about fear, talk mm-hmm. about emotions, you talk mm-hmm. about and we'll break some of this down as we go along,
sure.
but it seems like these are, you know, people feel very strongly because there are a lot of stakes involved in these questions.
Right. That's the heart of it. I think there's a lot of the underlying elements of it has to do with this one human emotion, which is fear.
Fear, yeah.
It's really about losing a livelihood or fear or not wanting to kill things or you know, losing that sense of value. So that's the thing that's motivating a lot of people here. And it tends to result in overreactions. So a cougar seen somewhere near town and every school's in lockdown and everybody's panicking about it. And so I think we overreact rather than have measured rational approaches to things because we're afraid.
Yeah. The system of predator control, mm-hmm. I want to ask a little bit about that because you write about sort of to get us into this. I think we need to talk about numbers and some
sure.
of the history of this kind of thing. You mentioned this system of predator control wasn't created in a day.
Right.
And you kind of write about how it was – what I think was so interesting about this is the way the name evolves. You know, we have these concerns about essentially – gosh, should we be killing all these predators? You know, and how are we killing them? And so as we express those concerns from throughout history, we keep changing the name of the organization. Talk a little bit about the history of all of this.
Right. Yes, Wildlife Services has been around in some shape or form for, was it 1914 or so? It made sense at first. So we're developing the West. There's large predators out there trying to get agriculture going. And that's what we knew how to do. And so as things developed, the agency would change names. It would change where is – a lot of it's just the bureaucratic nature of the federal government
right.
and moving things around. Then things changed a bit in the 40s, 50s where the technologies came. This is why I kind of consider this as a war in a lot of ways. The technology is outstripping a lot of times our rational thoughts about what we're doing. And we went from, you know, trappers and bounties and those kinds of things to actually putting people in airplanes and helicopters and flying around shooting things.
This was the technology of war.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, the technology war really comes into play here. Then as we got into the 70s, the environmental movements started happening and the nature of wildlife management started changing. Then things would shift around to be, you know, instead of being blatantly about predator control or animal damage control, which is still a resound. You mentioned that word in among certain crowds, and people tense up.
Yeah.
And then it became Wildlife Services to kind of portray, give them the benefit of the doubt. That's a lot of what they're trying to do. They're trying to provide a service relative to wildlife.
But they do seem like euphemisms, don't they?
Everything is it is. They have bounded around different names, you know, for years.
Yeah.
But I think arguing about I think getting too focused on a particular method or a particular dichotomy or a particular word, I mean, that's part of our problem.
Yeah.
We rally behind a word instead of thinking what we need to do to go forward on this.
So how do we kill these animals? I have to say let's talk about the numbers in a moment. Aerial hunts, that's one thing in particular you write about. Again, that technology that came from war. We had the ability to really get low
right.
to the ground. Give us a sense of how we are killing predators these days.
Well, variety of ways. Since back in the 70s, so Nixon, interestingly enough, is one of our more environmental presidents in a lot of ways. And one of the first things he did was to stop strychnine, baits, poisons on federal lands and things. So what happened then, all of a sudden, one of the major tools for predator control was gone.
Yeah.
And that really – and then at the same time, again, we had this technology of aircraft. So that really filled the gap for a lot of states, at least western states. And so especially in places like Utah or Wyoming or, you know, large desert areas the way it's typically done, you wait for winter, you wait for good snow, then you get the aircraft up, and then recently after a snow, they can follow the tracks and then find the animals that way. There's also ways to have crews on the ground. They can howl up coyotes, for instance, and when they hear the coyotes, they can vector the aircraft in. Again, it's this kind of military-like operation.
Totally.
But it's still artful, too. It's not as – it's still difficult, you know. And people die doing this. Yeah. And that's another aspect we should probably address.
Yeah, too. It is. It's you mentioned, in fact, how risky it can be. Let me ask you this, though.
Sure.
The death toll. Mm-hmm. Now, 2011, something on the order of 84,000 wolves, coyotes, bears, and lions were killed.
Mm-hmm.
By the Department of Agriculture, by these programs. But all told, and this was the thing I found striking, something like 3.7 million animals killed altogether, because you've got because you're not just killing these predators. And in fact, I wanted to let me go to this page because I found this remarkable. I want to ask you about this.
Okay.
So the list of species killed intentionally or not by agents, several pages long, you mentioned. It includes such species as the American avocet, the white-winged dove, the eastern bluebird, the rustic bunting, the northern cardinal, the harlequin duck, the desert cottontail rabbit, the gopher snake, the tundra swan, the downy woodpecker. It's 326 entries long. Why are we killing those creatures?
Like I said, if it's a war, there's collateral damage. And sometimes some of those species in that list, these are from the agency's reports that go out. And, you know, how inadvertent, what the particular instances of any particular animal, I don't know. But, you know, when you're throwing this much lead at the problem.
So wait, so to get 84,000 predators.
Mm-hmm.
We killed 3 million other creatures.
Well, no, that's not entirely the case, too. So here's a difficulty, and here's something difficult about the numbers. The numbers are big, but a lot of those millions are things like blackbirds for agricultural crops. This book focuses just on the predator aspect of things, but there's a lot of blackbirds, there's a lot of starlings, there's a lot of those kinds of things that are just whole, large scale, taking out millions of animals. You know, relative to the populations, are they impacting the populations of these species? Here's the interesting thing here. They're not really impacting the populations, but those numbers are huge.
Yep.
So which way do you want to look at this? And that's what we're getting at here.
Well, I have to say, that's the striking thing, 3.7
right.
million. And that was 2011. That was a low year.
Yeah.
It was more than 4 million, I think, the year after, maybe the year before.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the thing that people are responding to.
Right.
You know, millions of creatures are being killed.
Exactly. So there's this kind of strange – and it's – a lot of the rhetoric that I see, especially about Wildlife Service, is interesting because people say it's a secretive agency and they're doing all this and nobody knows about it. People know about – I mean, you've got to give them credit. One of the good things about a government agency doing this is a government agency is held responsible for it. They publish this stuff. They say what they're doing. They say how they're trying to do it, and they say what they're doing. And so those numbers are out there. Again, it's are we going to respond to these numbers, or are we going to accept the numbers, or where does it fit in? What do we want? I mean, that's the paradox here. Do you want to kill these things or not? Or do you?
That's right.
Is it the right amount? Is it not the right amount?
That's the question you want to get at.
Right.
You want to have that conversation.
Exactly.
There's this term. I don't know if it's David Quammen's term exactly, but he was one of them who's mentioned this, called weed species.
Exactly.
Coyotes are a weed species. They're awesome, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of they can survive anything. It's they're the things that are going to survive all of us probably, right? And humans are that way too. It's interesting you talk about. We're probably a weed species in some way. But it raises the question that I wanted to ask you about, which you ask in the book. Is nature supposed to be this even lawn, you know, like this beautiful grass garden without competition, without variation? And should we set humans apart from nature? Talk about those questions because those are big ones that you've got going.
Those are deep, you know, the book, you can't address carnivore or predator management in the U.S. without getting into value systems and a certain amount of philosophy. So I had to have some of those discussions and I had to have some of those thoughts about it. And as I've thought a lot about this over the years, I've really realized part of it and part of the misunderstanding is this loss of connection between us and where we are in the environment. This idea that nature's out there and we're here.
Yeah.
And I look at that as tragic, truly tragic. I think, you know, one of my best experiences is, you know, be able to look down and see a cougar track, or, you know that thing's around someplace, see a grizzly bear, you know, or and have that feeling that you're not only the top of the food chain, you can just be on the bottom of it. And there's a certain amount of that's real living, is realizing that, you know, there's some cost to living, that there's some difficulties living, there's some pain to living. But that's real life too. If we make everything into a manicured lawn, sure, that's pretty, but is that still living anymore? Yeah. Is that still nature? And you talked about, I dedicated this to my son. And a lot of the movements that are trying to reconnect us to where our food comes from, the Michael Pollan, the Louvre's Last Child in the Woods, those kinds of things are really important to me. I want my child to not just see a cougar in a zoo. You know, I want them to know that they're on the landscape, but also to realize that there are some costs associated with that.
Yeah. There's a story you tell in the book. I want to have you read this section about you went hunting for an elk. You decided to apply for an elk permit. Did you feel conflicted about that at first? Why did you decide to do that?
It's about – there's a variety of reasons, and there's not any one simple answer. The story is more about, at a basic level, is where your food comes from. People like to think of, you know, grass-fed and hormone-free and free-range. Well, there's nothing more free-range, hormone-free, grass-fed than wild game.
Yep.
The other aspect of it, the other reasoning here, was that I'm responsible for the meat that I bring home. And there's that connection there. And that really helps me in a really deep way. It's not just a plastic-wrapped hunk of protein. It's something that my blood, sweat, tears were into, you know, went into. That normally what we do now is we pay somebody else, to a farmer or a rancher. It's their blood, sweat, and tears that go into the protein that we eat. And I think there's something – I mean, we all have to make our choices of where we want to be on this continuum. And from my perspective, my choice is, if I'm going to eat meat, I want to be prepared to accept the responsibility, the pain of doing that.
Yeah.
The difficulty here is, I don't want to sound preachy or expect everybody to do the same thing. You got to choose where you want to be on this continuum. But there is this, you know, if you want to think globally, act locally, that's my choice. This is what I'm going to do. I wish more people would do it too, because I think it's a good, healthy way to interact with the environment in a real way, but also in a way that you're gaining. I mean, it's food. It's our connection to the natural world.
Yeah. Read this section, if you would. I really liked this part. It talked about how you went through this process.
Okay. Dropping my pack and slinging the rifle, I begin the stalk, moving low, staying in cover and downwind of the small herd. I crawl to the edge of the forest and steady the rifle against the tree that obscures me from view. I breathe slowly, completing my internal conversation with death. The life lost will not be my own, but I want it to be as quick, painless, and sudden as I'd want it for myself. I contain my thoughts and focus. On a gentle exhalation, I adduct my finger against the trigger. A slow, even draw, as though I am beckoning a lover toward me. How much less meat would each of us eat if we had to harvest our own? How much more would we respect nature if we lived with it, versus storing its ideals away in parks and on nature shows? What would happen if those of us who sprawl across the landscape learned to bond with it, to cut a few links in the chain that binds us to an agricultural industry that demands our bloated consumption? To this day, when I pull a package of elk meat from the freezer, my heartbeat quickens. I relive the moment of taking a life in order to sustain my own. I remember the animal suddenly disappearing from view, a sentient, feeling animal removed forever from existence. I see the other animals look around. They heard the shot like distant thunder. They do not run in panic. Unaware of my presence, they stare dumbly in various directions. They do not seem to notice that one of their herd has collapsed in a heap. After a few moments, they wander over the hill and out of sight. I stumble down to her.
That's John Shivick. His book is called The Predator Paradox, Ending the War with Wolves, Bears, Cougars, and Coyotes. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Thank you. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the war on predators here in the West and elsewhere. We've been fighting this war, of course, for a long time now, killing wolves and coyotes and bears and cougars and lots of other creatures get caught in that crossfire. Our guest today is the wildlife biologist John Shivick, who believes there is a way past this ongoing and very emotional battle. He has a game plan for using science and good sense to negotiate this uneasy terrain. He lays it out in his book called The Predator Paradox, Ending the War with Wolves, Bears, Cougars, and Coyotes. I wanted to ask you about I want to sort of lay out some of the characters that we talk about in the book, but let's have a – there's this setting that you also write about. It's the Predator Research Facility. Say something a little bit about that. I mean, this is a place that the idea is to sort of figure out how predators behave, how they'll respond to certain things.
Right. It's largely – it's associated with Utah State. It's Utah State and USDA. And the kind of the grandfather there is Fred Knowlton, professor that retired a few years ago. And he started it up. He sort of had the vision and foresight to realize, hey, we need to know more about these animals physiologically and behaviorally. And he created this 165-acre facility. Nowadays, they've got room for about 100 coyotes there.
Wow.
So it allows for a lot of research to be done. I mean, there's no place else like it in the world. And it's right here in Utah. It's pretty cool.
There are a number of characters, these sort of contrasting personalities.
Right.
Let's start with Lynn Gilbert Norton. She's a great character, I have to say. Uh-huh. Grew up in England.
Exactly.
And what's great about – I think it's remarkable. She grows up – and you point this out in the book. She grows up in, you know, England, this island that a long time ago really tamed – and got rid of all of their large predators. Talk about her as a character.
Right. Lynn's a fabulous human being and a wonderful scientist and all of these things. That was a great learning experience for me. I think as a professor, if you're doing it right, you're learning as much from your students, probably far more than you're teaching them. And Lynn was definitely one of those people in the sense of here's somebody coming from a different environment. She was a psychologist at the time by training. She came over first for a placement from the University of Exeter and a master's of psychology. And one of the first things I learned from her was that, I was just trained to be a wildlife biologist. I was trained to have that narrow tunnel vision and think about the world in a particular way. And it was nice to work so closely with somebody from a different realm. Lynn is way more on the welfare side of things and, you know, she's definitely vegetarian for years and that kind of thing. So it was really good to kind of for us to work together and kind of, you know, she ignored me at the right times,
right,
which was really nice. And we got to learn things because of that, which is great.
So she represents one perspective. And there's another one, Patrick Darrow, you write about.
Right.
Grew up in northern Utah, goes
Southern
on a
Idaho.
Mormon mission.
Mm-hmm.
Idaho?
Georgia. Or he grew up in Idaho, yeah.
And grows up on a family farm, but has hay fever, so he turns away from the family farm.
Yeah.
But his farming background gives him a very different perspective.
Exactly, exactly. And there's something there about that humanizes the other element of it. The rhetoric frustrates me because it comes out as those evil farmers and ranchers or those wacko kooks on the other side of it, and it doesn't humanize and tell a story. You know, Lynn's got a story and very rational reasons for thinking of the world the way she thinks about it. Patrick's the same way. And it really kind of drives home, you know, these people are working for a living, and they're doing this because it's a way of life. It's a passion. If you're ranching or farming, it's a passion. It's not something – it's not a purely economic thing. There's more to it than that. And that's something I can learn from Patrick. Also, he's just a naturally really smart, talented guy at the same time too. So I've just been real lucky to surround myself with great students.
But is that important for those who are trying to get perspective is to broaden the people you talk to give a – a broader sense of what this story is really about.
Yeah, yeah. I think that is exactly what the story is about. It's about getting out of your comfort zone, understanding a little bit about why other people value things and think about things the way they do. It's almost a little facetious, but I'm right in all of my opinions because they're mine, right?
Yeah.
But everybody else has the right to be wrong too. you know, or at least to the right to develop things the way they've developed them. And I think, you know, the right way going forward is both understanding, you know, each one's a human being and each one has a reason for thinking the way they do and finding that common ground and then going forward there.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call. Alex is joining us in Orem, Utah. Alex, welcome.
Yeah, I was really encouraged to hear your take on hunting. I'm a hunter myself. One thing, though, I do find disturbing is that there are a lot of hunters. It sounds like you really adhere to what Aldo Leopold described as hunting ethics and recognizing the social value of hunting and the man-earth relationship. But there's actually an excellent article you'd probably be interested in by Robert Holtzman, himself is a hunter and a researcher, that indicates that most hunters actually don't really value biological diversity, and they're just really interested in having more game animals. And that we see here in Utah with groups like Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, where it really just appears to be about trophy hunting and conspicuous consumption.
This is a dicey one, right? I mean, this is a big issue here, this question of whether or not – now, it's hard to ascribe a motive to anyone. So whether you want to do that or not, which is to say hunters don't care about biodiversity. All they care about is big antlers. How do you respond to that?
I respond that I see, and that's the rhetoric where it pigeonholes people. And it's weird for me to put a section on hunting into a book that's about predators, except that that's the connection with me and food, and that's where I'm coming from. And I'm not the only one that thinks this way about hunting and about getting out and about the natural environment. Yeah, a lot of people – I mean, there's a lot of people that are just out in all the fancy gear fishing in the same way and doing it very – you know, they're fly fishing. They've got all the right stuff. But there's a lot of guys just taking their sons or daughters out too, and it's the same way with hunting. Hunting is a long family tradition. Are there different ways to look at it? Yeah, there are some groups that are really into the trophy kind of thing, and there's a lot of people that are a lot more about opportunity. And that varies state by state too. You know, Utah is just one place where we're thinking about these things. So the only thing I would say to respond to that, I just be careful about overly categorizing hunters as one way or another, because people, coyotes, wolves – they're all individuals, you know, and there's all different personalities and motivations here. But that's our first thing we need to accept.
Do you get a sense, though, that the pursuit of certain groups for trophies, for large animals, large, you know, cow, bull elk or whatever, bucks, is that in some way driving the concern for predators in the West, in Utah, in a way that it shouldn't? Maybe is that concern driving the way we look at predators in a way?
It's a mix. So we have to lay the groundwork first in the context. The reason we have ungulate species these days is because sportsmen got together, Teddy Roosevelt and gang, back, you know, in the, you know, in, like in, gosh, early 1920s, I think there might have been 5,000 deer in Utah. People saw that this is an issue and created this modern wildlife management. And these same people, you know, these are the same attitudes and stuff that brought these animals back. That's a darn good thing. And the predator relationship, again, and this is what we're trying to figure out. And you can see policies across all the states are back and forth on this, is when you're controlling predators, when you're not controlling predators, because it's not that simple issue.
Let me ask you about you write about this woman named Diane Boyd, mm-hmm. Who made this presentation, I think it was 1999, that kind of struck you as something that was important at the time. She was really honest.
Yeah.
And she's talking to a group of wildlife biologists, I think, and others.
A mix, yeah.
And she said that she worried that they were painting themselves into a corner when they – didn't deal with the real threats of predators, like wolves, for example. She talks about this idea of it's important in the conversation to be honest with people, because you say predators are designed to kill things.
Exactly.
That's their job. And you say the human reaction to the way they kill is this kind of cognitive dissonance, is how you describe it, which creates these myths and symbols that aren't really completely accurate. Talk about that, if you would.
Right. So that was a pretty interesting presentation. Boy, I've been in this business a while now. And a lot of the rhetoric, especially early on in the days of wolves coming back, was it was all about Little Red Riding Hood is wrong. And it became a discussion about myths instead of reality. And to me, you can't have the good wolf, wonderful spiritual brother aspect of a wolf without having – they kill things.
Yeah.
That's what they do. And it's not pretty. So you have to have both those elements. And I think it was dishonest, especially at the time, it still happens, to say that it's this one – they're these wonderful beasts and they either – don't kill things, or it's not as messy as it looks. Or if they do kill things, it's okay for them to, but for humans not to. And see, I'm trying to get us to kind of be honest about those discussions, and we're really reluctant to do that.
There's this tragic story that plays out here in Utah in, I think it was 2007, in American Fork Canyon.
Yeah,
11-year-old boy, Samuel Ives was his name, pulled from a tent, killed by a black bear. And there's been some legal wrangling going on for a number of years now over who's to blame. And I'm wondering, what do you make of that part of the story when a predator, you know, what does this tell us about this story, do you think?
There's three aspects to it. One, there's an also kind of a related note. There's a mountain lion attack in Colorado several years ago as well. And I discussed this a little bit where the arguments got really vociferous because David Baron wrote a pretty famous book about it.
Yeah. Called The Beast in the Garden. We had him on the show, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
And a man was killed by a cougar.
Exactly.
There was one activist, Wendy Kefauver Ring,
mm-hmm.
furious about the book.
Right.
And so they engaged in this, as you said, pretty vociferous debate.
Yeah, exactly. In academic sort of journal articles and things. And what they're both, they're kind of they're arguing. She was intensely worried that you have a death and that the pendulum is going to swing and people are going to be overcome by fear and worried about everything. So she was worried that Baron was writing this book and he's kind of capitalizing on that.
Sensationalizing
the
story.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, in truth, in my reading of it, he wasn't sensationalizing it quite as much as she thought and vice versa. And so it became one of those, again, these silly semantic arguments where people are arguing over words and meaning and all that kind of stuff when it's documenting what can happen. Is it rare for a bear to kill a person or a cougar to kill a person? Yeah. It's, 400 times more likely to be struck, killed by lightning than to be killed by a mountain lion. That's pretty rare. But these things, because we're so passionate, because we're so fearful on it, we can jump on them pretty quickly. And then when you get the legal system involved, then that's way out of my realm.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about you write about this is interesting how you put it. Few human activities as ancient as raising sheep.
Yeah.
There's the kind of biblical importance connected to it. And you write about going to this gathering in, I think it was Las Cruces, New Mexico.
It was, yes.
And you seem to be really kind of inspired, is how you put it, by
absolutely.
The young. Do they call themselves shepherds? Do they call themselves sheep herders?
A lot of times wool growers.
Wool growers, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But you were struck by I don't know. I guess you seem like you figured there might be hope for this thing that you're after and seeing the way they were talking about this issue.
Right. There's a real self-reliance. There's a real the rhetoric and the way people are painted, they're dehumanized. And it was the neatest thing in all the livestock producers that I've worked with. They've been great. The passion for what they do has come through. And you can see, the sparkle in their eyes when they look out over the range and they see their animals and they see their kids interacting with the animals. It's the neatest thing. And you can see, I want to raise my kids in this really healthy way. And there's all this discussion, again, the last child in the woods, there's all these urban movements about retouching with nature. Well, who's doing it? Those folks are doing it. They're walking the talk. And in that particular instance, a lobbyist more or less would come in and say, here, we're going to get you guys these subsidies. We're going to get you guys this money. And this was kind of my first learning experience as this whole story developed. It wasn't for the money that they're doing it. They wanted to help themselves. They're saying, we want to do this. We can do this. We will, we want to raise our livestock. We just need to be able to deal with the predators. And we want you to give us the tools. We don't want handout. They're proud people.
Yeah.
And that was a real learning experience and something where I'm like, wow, we can do that. We can give people tools. We can help themselves.
You said that you felt that there was a kind of honesty and purity in their passion and the way they connected to it. So is it a younger generational sensibility, or is it this new ethic about food reconnecting with land that you're seeing and gives you a sense of hope that we can maybe figure this out?
I think so. I think that's where the timing is right here, where we're now discussing food, where food comes from. There's ideas such, there are a lot of people, especially back east, are doing a lot more of these smaller farms and things. There's a lot of the locavore and all that.
Yeah.
We're really paying attention to that kind of thing. And there's movements now, too. There's the whole wildlife friendly, and their goal is to create economies to help ecologies is the way I think they phrase it. But it's sort of realizing, wow, here's where my food comes from. I don't only have to choose organic and – because people are making a choice saying, oh, I'm going to have organic because that's better for the environment, whatever reason. Well, you can also choose and use economic forces to be a predator-friendly food production as well. And we're starting to have
those discussions. It's become a label, right? Predator-friendly has become a label.
Right. So now it's a certified thing that it's getting steam. So that's going to be the way, people are doing it because they're passionate, but economics are a part of the equation.
Of course. Because the crucial question comes up as well, as you say, look, humans need protein.
Yeah.
And what happens then, you write, if we just get rid of the livestock on the range? Would that then end the conflicts? And as you say, it's not that simple.
Right. Well, and here's the thing. People talk about what method works or ending a conflict. I'm not trying to end a conflict. I'm trying to keep this conflict going, right? If we wanted to have a solution for wolves and cattle, we could get rid of all the cattle, or we can get rid of all the wolves, get rid of all the people. Now, are those viable solutions? No. I think we're extremely—
Because the conflict is natural.
Yeah. I mean, we're different species sharing a world. We're supposed to be conflicting, So the idea is how do we deal with that in a healthy, economically sound, environmentally sound, morally sound? Are we going to deal with these issues and these conflicts in a good way or not? I mean, that's the question. And I think there's more and more tools to do, to have kind of a softer footprint out there.
I want to talk about some of those particular ways when we get back from a break. John Shivick is with us. His book is called The Predator Paradox, Ending the War with Wolves, Bears, Cougars, and Coyotes. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with wildlife biologist John Shivick. We're talking about his new book, The Predator Paradox, Ending the War with Wolves, Bears, Cougars, and Coyotes. So we talk about this idea of how you find that balance in the paradox and how you do it in a harmonious way, balancing human and biological systems, minimizing environmental costs. And this is the thing that you kind of specialize in some way. Let's talk about how you do that, because there are a number of different kinds of methods. A few things that struck me. One method you write about is called animal armor. Mm-hmm. It's this – well, explain what it is. It's this plastic collar.
Right. Yeah, there's a it's sort of developed out of South Africa, and it's a plastic collar. And there's different ways to do this. Coyotes, for instance, they kill in a very stereotypical way. They'll grab an animal by the throat. They suffocate it, actually. And they'll kill it that way or knock it down. So there's ideas to put, you know, really cheap plastic slippery collars on these animals that can – so a coyote can't grip it. Is that the be-all, end-all solution? No, because coyotes can and will
– adapt.
Adapt, yeah.
That's what they're good at, yeah.
And here's the thing. I kind of want to lead this discussion here with a little bit of this acknowledging that there's a continuum here. I specialize in non-lethal methods. You know, that's what I've been doing for most of my career. But, you know, it goes from, you know, from it's not a dichotomy. It's not just lethal or non-lethal, yeah. Even though that's the way the language is. And there isn't any one thing. If somebody's looking for to pick this up and say, oh, there's going to be a magic bullet, we're going to be done with this, that's not going to happen. However, we can find that if we adapt appropriate methods to particular situations, then we can resolve issues. Sometimes guard dogs are a good thing with coyotes. You know, one guard dog and wolves, not such a good thing.
Yeah.
Wolves will see that guard dog as a territorial intruder and kill it. So, but then there's things like flattery, which is hanging flags around a pasture, which repels wolves and coyotes to some extent. But does that work on a huge open range? No. But then you might have range riders and things. So you've got flags, you've got electronics, you've got – what I'm really curious about is not only what we have now, but if we start thinking about this way
– what could we come up with?
Yeah. Gosh, if you know – if I'm getting my – if my Amazon's delivering my books with a drone, there might be some other options we have out there. And it isn't just all rocket science either. I mean, there's just shed lambing. There's the FLIRD idea where you're
explain what
mixing.
That is, because this is you're mixing. This I think what's so interesting about this idea of FLIRD, which is mixing herds, cows and sheep,
right?
Essentially, but there's always been the cattlemen. There's always been the ranchers,
yeah.
The sheep ranchers, and yeah. They've never mixed very well,
right? So
there's a cultural dynamic.
We've got to kind of break down some barriers here, and I think some of those things. There's cultural stuff. There's historical stuff, but a lot of those things are breaking down naturally as we're starting to mix and starting to change economic pressures about food and where it's coming from. And if you mix cattle and sheep. You know, they're browsing differently. It can use the range a little bit better. And then having bigger animals among the smaller animals can dissuade smaller predators like coyotes and things. So, again, it's not the solution, but it's another thing that people can try.
Andy asks an obvious question. He sends this from Salt Lake City. He says, why are you avoiding the issue of vegetarianism? He says, wouldn't that be the simplest solution? If people don't eat meat, it solves everything, he says. The whole issue of predators, livestock, everything. It's also a change that can be made individually. There's no need for collective action if individually we choose to be vegetarian.
Right. And that's an excellent point. The only thing is it still follows through. It assumes that because you're not eating meat that you've got no impact on the environment. I like the whitewater kayak. And when I see a dam go up to move water to irrigate a soybean crop somewhere, and I'm eating nothing but soybeans and tofu, I'm still impacting that environment. But if I look at something like a grass-fed, now we have to leave the feedlot kind of stuff out of this, right? But if I look at a grass-fed animal, an elk, that's got less impact than farming does. So I think we have to choose where we want to be on that continuum.
So stopping meat, that's not going to solve it. That's
yeah,
not
and, the and there's certain things we can't turn grass into protein. Cows can. Elk can. And at some point, we still need the protein. And which method are we going to go? The nice thing is, and especially in the arid West, animals can do these tricks that humans can't do without planting special and irrigating special crops. So yes, I think eating less meat, I think that's a great thing. And then really choosing where your meat comes from is also a great thing. But you're never, you know, we live here. We're paving. We're growing crops. We're always having an impact. The problem isn't solved. It's just sort of shifting where the pressures are.
You offer some kind of gentle criticism of the conservation movement in the book, or anyway, the people who you know, give checks as a way of assuaging their guilt or disconnecting them in some way. At least that's the thing you worry about a little bit from the problem. You call it cultural displacement behavior.
Exactly. It is so. You know, I think. It's hard to not see the numbers and the number of predators killed and all this kind of thing and not get swept up in it. it's even more difficult to not get swept on it, up in it when you've got conservation organizations with, I'll avoid naming names, but, you know, a $2 million plus a year marketing budget, whereas the whole Western wolf recovery is not much more than that, $2 to $3 million a year. These people are putting more in marketing and selling something. And they're selling things like the wolf is on the edge of extinction when you've got over through Alaska, North America, continental U.S., we've got 70,000 or so wolves. There's 12,000 wolves in Europe. And this kind of crisis gets people swept up. And the first thing you want to do is assuage your guilt. And the easiest way to do that, oh, I'll write a check to these folks. And I wish we'd get more involved at that local level rather than writing away guilt with a check. And there's a lot of conservation groups doing great things. I don't, again, don't let it, you know, don't wrap it all up and overextend my comments here. But there's a lot of conservation groups that are, they're about more than just, you know, saving a species.
You say something kind of provocative in the book.
Only one thing?
A number of things kind of provocative. And it gets to, somebody mentioned, or a caller earlier mentioned Aldo Leopold, legendary environmentalist, in his examination of the costs and benefits of our relationship with predators. He tells this story, this famous story about seeing the fierce green of a wolf's eyes when he had shot it, dying.
Mm, it's a real famous quote.
It's a famous quote. And you tell this story when you were doing this experiment, trying to capture and put these training collars on these young wolves. But you write about the fourth wolf, their mother. She was old and tired, as you say, and she'd been tranquilized with this drug. Normally pretty safe mm-hmm. dosages. Mm-hmm. But she was having a really difficult time shaking off its effects. Tell that story, if you would, and I want to have you read this section.
Go ahead and read this from here.
Yeah. Do you want to say something about this to set this up?
Yeah. So, oh, it was a complicated experiment. So what we're doing, we're looking at the use of electronic training collars. So same, you know, electric collars that people put on their dogs to train them to do this or not do particular things. And we were investigating this as a method to teach this pack of wolves not to attack livestock, essentially. And as in wildlife biology, when you're dealing with animals and individuals and personalities and all that kind of thing, things don't always play out exactly like the way you want them to. And it was a real learning experience for me.
You say that Leopold, in his writing, he missed something. He fell short.
Yeah.
Read this section, if you would.
We could not tell what the she-wolf could see or feel as she lifted her head intermittently. We could not detect the visions that were playing behind the steel of her eyes. Perhaps she was studying the visage of death. I looked again into the wolf's eyes. I can see, in their dying glaze, the fierce green fire, too. But the moment was not one of some greater understanding of the universe. In the eyes of the wolf, there was no magic, no calm dignity. In the eyes of the wolf was recognition. She had no control of her limbs. She had strange and terrifying creatures hovering above her as the world swirled into ghostly shapes of shadows and grays. The wolf shared with me more than it shared with Leopold's mountain. The vision behind the eyes was a mammalian emotion, a fellow feeling, and not the stoic permanence and wisdom of ancient granite. In the pale green fire that I saw that day was the piercing intensity of fear.
Which tells you what? There wasn't something romantic going on. She was just afraid.
Yeah.
As she died.
It's an animal. It's not a mountain. I think we can get a little too lofty and distant. And as we're thinking about the long term, which we absolutely should do, the real decisions are those day-by-day decisions about how you're going to eat or how you're going to respond to a cougar in town or a bear in a campground. And it's also a realization that, you know, humans and animals, we share a lot of the same things. You know, we share the same fears. We share, you know, we share the same desires. We need to eat too, just like a wolf needs to eat. And there's a real realization in the kind of the guts of that, the pain there and the reality of it. And that's the struggle, I think, philosophically here, is to accept that nature's red in tooth and claw. It's tough. And we're not going to get a peaceable kingdom out of this. But we can have a pretty cool place to live if we figure out how to live with these things better.
I guess I'll go back to that wool growers gathering in Las Cruces that gave you what I gathered to be kind of sense of hope. Do you feel optimistic that we can strike that balance?
Oh, yeah. How can I not be? I mean, again, we're looking at our relationship with the environment differently now. I think we're bringing it home more. I think we're really thinking about getting our kids in the woods more. I think it's about livestock producers understanding, again, you know, there's organic movements, there's wildlife friendly movements, there's all the pieces are there now. It's just a matter of connecting these dots for folks. And that's what I wanted to try to do in this argument, is connect these dots so we can move forward. And yeah, I can't give up. My whole life has been dedicated to making these things work and making these things happen. And I think it's going to get better. I mean, we've got cougars are expanding. Coyotes are in more places than they've ever been.
Central Park.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the subways in Seattle. So, yeah, they're everywhere. And now it's really important for us to get this conversation going so the pendulum doesn't flip back the other way and we start shooting with fear again. You know, we need to know that there are things we can do to live with these critters. And that's where my source of optimism is that we can live with having more of these around. And that's just a better world. That's a cooler place to be.
It's John Shivick. This book is called The Predator Paradox, Ending the War with Wolves, Bears, Cougars, and Coyotes. And John Shivick, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.